See, I think we got up to the time, the holding of the press conference, following his meeting with Hua Guofeng and the signing of the hydropower protocols. And then the press conference, which went quite well. The press was not, representatives were not really pressing him very hard on any matters, but it went quite well.
In fact, that was part of the, another part of the trip that had been well planned and then well executed. Under his very capable assistant, Al Isley, we had departed for China with a press plan. That plan included what news would be released every day and what items would be held back till the end. So that we could have an accomplishment a day. And we stuck to that and had news every day, including at the end the establishment of the consulate in Canton. And we had not, that had not broken. That was something that was accomplished as far as the news media were concerned at the very end.
Well, that kind of planning is really very useful, because when you get a news-starved press like there is in a capital like Peking, they expect something every time they there's a meeting or a day goes by to plan it out so that there is something that, which can be the centerpiece, makes mm-hmm. a great deal of sense.
Mm-hmm. And Dennis Clift, just one other insight into how the Mondale visit was planned. Dennis Clift was his aide for this trip and the head staff person. And what Dennis had before we left was a separate file for each event, literally broken down to every dinner, to every toast, every statement that Mondale would make. I think it came out over the course of what, nearly a week trip, into something like 50 or 60 separate events. And then there was a scenario written for every event, why it was taking place, who would be there, and we just, once there, just mowed through these, including every press statement and all of that.
And the final event at Peking, of course, was the social event, rather, was the return banquet in the Great Hall. That was a very colorful and warm affair, much smaller, as you have noted, than the reception banquet they gave for him a couple of days earlier.
But still one where the surprise was that the Chinese provided their orchestra free of charge. We didn't know that it was even going to be there, as I recall. So we had music
I think
for
that's
hours
true.
As well.
Right. And pretty good performers.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good performers. And the next morning, the party went to the Great Wall, as you remembered, because I did not accompany them. And then as the vice president came back to the guest house to have lunch and also for the purpose of having all of the embassy staff and families come out to the guest house to have the chance to meet him, which was a great contribution to our morale, and everybody was extremely pleased with that. And then left for Xi'an in the mid-afternoon of Wednesday, August 29, got there around 5 o'clock, drove quite a long way to the guest house, which was quite a bit out of town.
southwest of town at the Shanxi Provincial Guest House.
Right. And then the welcoming banquet, where was that? Do you remember?
It was in the auditorium within the provincial guest house.
That's right. We just had a short walk. And that was... that was on that evening. And the vice president, as usual, performed very well. As I take it, that would have been event number 32 or something.
That's right, with the toast and all. That was perhaps the warmest single event, that particular banquet, during my entire experience with China. You will remember that, it led me to believe that the Chinese have the capacity for infinite gradations of warmth. And in this one, people began going from one table to the other. There was much more table hopping. And people were genuinely reluctant to leave, as I recall.
Yeah. It lasted much longer than the normal 2 hours. That's true.
And even some people began singing. It was just quite an evening.
There were many toasts offered at the various tables. And, it was a great deal of movement, and the Chinese joined right in. It was not one-sided with just the Americans doing it.
That's
by any
right.
means. Then the next morning, of course, went out to the excavations of the Qinshihuangdi tomb. See those great terracotta figures. The Chinese had worked extremely hard to finish up that exhibit area. When I first saw the excavations in Sharon and I, it was in June of 78. At that time, they'd covered it all back in, except the only figures available were the six figures they had in a little shed, just for exhibit purposes. But they'd covered it all in for the purpose of erecting about a superstructure to cover an area much bigger than a football field. And they had finished the approaches and the steps and everything just almost hours before this Thursday morning, preparation for the vice president's visit. And you remember the long negotiations over the picture taking, which finally resulted in the allowance for one still photographer. That, of course, I think was prompted on the Chinese side by trying to protect this from commercial exploitation over which they had no control. But that visit was a really memorable event, and we've used that word quite a bit in connection with this visit, but the whole visit was truly memorable.
Yeah. Who will forget the crowds lining the streets
yes, after
of
we
Xi'an.
Left that, right. And the motorcade, which was the vice president stopped on two or three occasions so he could get out and wade into the crowds, American campaign style. How the crowds responded. There were tremendous numbers on the streets. I saw nothing like that at any other time in China. I saw lots of crowds gather because in that society with so many people, the slightest incident draws a crowd. But
there were 20, 30 deep
for several...
Well, I guess one would say 2-3 miles.
Yes, at least. And I remember we were several cars back, and Sharon and I made no attempt to move up to where the vice president was. And on one occasion when he stopped, we got out of our car, and there were three small children, including a little girl that had been about 10. With a beautiful face, and a young pioneer. That's not the Chinese expression, is it?
Yeah.
Red neckerchief. And they stood still for us to take, Sharon to take their pictures. And then Sharon knelt down to speak to her. And the little girl just was looking right into her eyes, didn't say a word, but she reached up and took off the neckerchief and handed it to Sharon. And then, again without saying a word, turned on her heel and ran away. But nobody prompted her. Nobody was telling her to do this. It was really, really very touching. And the crowd response, this wasn't just a put-on show.
No, I agree with you.
There was an electricity in the air that day that couldn't have been commanded.
And given the president standing in the polls at that time, the vice president was very much for including Shanxi in the Democratic primary season for the coming year. He also had with him the provincial governor and first party secretary named Li Ruixian, and it came as a jarring note. This is not the Chinese political style to stop a car and go out and plunge into a crowd. And the governor and first party secretary had to decide whether to do so or not. And eventually he joined Mondale. But it was clear that many of them did not know who he was and knew who the vice president was.
I see, yes.
So that they would shake his hand, all, but they weren't quite clear who this Chinese fellow was.
Well, of course, as you say, not the Chinese style. The Chinese style is an only... not to be seen in such a way, but not to be seen at all, with the red flag limousines always having curtains, not simply over the back window, the rear window, but also the side windows.
Right.
So that the occupants could not be seen by the masses. Right.
And you will remember the vice president had a very large entourage, not only he and his wife, his daughter, who loved to plunge into the crowds, but he brought along with him some of his friends from Minnesota.
Yes.
And he had the governor of South Carolina, Governor West, I believe is that
Riley.
His name?
Riley.
Governor Riley.
Who has some difficulty getting around because he's
right.
Crippled. He's a wonderful man.
Congressman Tim Foley from Washington, wasn't it?
State of Washington.
Washington.
Now the majority whip in the House.
Then he had the whole usual foreign policy staff elbowing each other to be close to him. And then a press, so that it ended up a caravan of 7-8 limousines, 2 buses, and then the TV people who wanted to get ahead of him when his limousine stopped so they could photograph
the
whole
thing.
They worked
very hard that morning.
And you will then remember everyone was, well, you were ahead of us. I was in one of the buses, and everyone was leaning out, waving. Dave Aaron, Dick Holbrook, we all became politicians in China.
Yeah, that was really extraordinary. Then we visited the petroleum instrument factory, where the vice president took considerable note of the things that they had ordered from the United States, which had not been delivered because of the export licensing problems.
Right.
And instructed notes to be taken to be checked out. I think there was some movement on some of those after his return.
In typical Mondale fashion, we, on our flight back, made a list again of every item that had come up where we were supposed to have an action follow-through, and then we had to chart this when we got back, and he kept on us for about 2 months, 3 months, till most
good.
Of it came, was done.
And then we made the visit to the Big Goose Pagoda on the way to the airport to take the plane to Guangzhou. And arrived at Guangzhou and
you couple other things he did in Xi'an. He had a stop at a vegetable market, you remember.
Oh, yes.
He went out and he bought a couple watermelons.
Right.
All that was well planned, too. Each of these, of course, each place that he went had been thought through. The
this
Chinese
was at a free market.
Free market, supposedly a free market, where my understanding is they brought a lot of goods in just knowing he was going to come.
I think it was a free market area, but it was specially stocked for
that's
that
right.
event, no question about
and
it.
And then what he bought, watermelon or something else, I don't remember. But all of this, again, each, as I recall now, we put the Chinese to a lot of work because we had requested each of these for what would go on the evening news. And we wanted a petroleum story very much for the vice president's trip.
Yes,
but
well, that was important.
We had thought of him going by helicopter to the South China Seas. Among the things that we had considered for this trip were going off to one of the seismic survey ships. We'd also considered diverting a naval carrier which had been picking up Vietnamese refugees and seeing whether we couldn't get it to go to Canton. Tremendous number of ideas thought through, but then you eliminate most of them. And each of
well,
these
we did approach
really
the
different.
Chinese about going out by helicopter and a seismic ship. That was a tremendous cost, of course.
That's right.
And, they were not only reluctant, I think, for that reason, but also the risk involved as they saw it.
We also were concerned no textile, not to go to any
because
textile
mill. That was still hanging fire.
That's right. Didn't want to draw American
right.
attention to the looming textile imports
right.
from China.
So then when we arrived in Guangzhou, we went with directly to the National Institute of the Peasant Movement, that historic site in Canton before we went on to the guest house.
The vice president would be ill-advised to go see Mao in Peking and visit the mausoleum. But he was interested in Chinese history, and he wanted to do something that would reflect his respect for the Maoist tradition in the party and his respect for the Chinese Revolution. So this looked like a good,
well, of course,
good spot.
Guangzhou had played a much more effective role in the revolution than Beijing ever did.
That's right.
It was most appropriate. Fit it in very well. And then the next day, the Huashan People's Commune particular memory of that.
Oh, we went for a long ride north of Canton, and then the vice president visited we explicitly requested visiting a village from which Chinese Americans came. And
oh, yeah.
This was a village there where 70% to 80% of the households had relatives in San Francisco and in the San Francisco area and in other Chinatowns. And then the vice president called on a family that had kept track of its American ancestors, the idea again of political. This was all as a result of that tongue lashing that David Aaron gave me. We just sort of sat and began to think, what are the political things that he ought to do? And then he visited a school, remember, and saw a classroom
yes.
in session.
Right.
And then he went to some outdoor performance, and some kids put on
a theatrical performance. I don't have any particular memory because that's the same routine
that's
I
right.
saw at every People's Commune I went to.
And then he went to, they wanted to take him to a local industry. But we scotched it at the last minute because it turned out to be a glove, a place where they manufacture gloves.
And work gloves.
Work gloves.
One of our contentious items.
So the vice president could not visit a local factory where work gloves were made, and much to our surprise, this, the advance people in the Mondale trip discovered that the labels in these gloves just said made in Hong Kong.
I didn't know that.
So he didn't go to that particular locale.
And then there was a luncheon sponsored by the American Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
At the Dongfang Hotel, which the vice president spoke, including the representative from the chamber in Taiwan, who was not very sympathetic, although he behaved properly on the occasion. And they had some pressing questions, including the tax problem, overseas tax problem, and other things.
Well, it was also here that the vice president vice president's word choice may not have been the most felicitous, because he referred to the forthcoming termination of our civil aviation agreement with Taiwan, and that we were going to make this a lot of these unofficial rather than official, and that our intent over a longer period of time was to terminate all of the official relations that we had, official agreements with Taiwan, and make them unofficial. And that really got more publicity than it should have, and that forced us to really modify how we were going to handle the gradual replacement of our official agreements with Taiwan. And it was the Taiwan person who pressed that question.
Right.
It caused a congressional reaction at home, a feeling that Congress had been misled as to exactly how we intended to deal with our various agreements with Taiwan and so on.
And then after the luncheon, of course, in the same hotel, he then dedicated the Consulate General, which was on the top floors of the hotel. And that was obviously a historic occasion, the first consulate to be dedicated after normalization. First one to be operative since 1949.
There were a couple offers. Were you involved in the selection of the site of that consulate, or was that left to admin?
I was peripherally involved.
Because that we had a building offered to us that we didn't take. Is that right? And I've always wondered about that. We were offered the Vietnamese building.
It was the old Vietnamese consulate on Xiamen Island, and it was inadequate, plus the fact that within 100 feet was going up a 30-story hotel, and the traffic way on the island, could not discover any planning for the increased traffic that such a huge hotel would bring about. We did discuss with them subsequently the possibility of get that land area, total reconstruction, but it never came to anything. Mm-hmm. And then they did make us a commitment, which we accepted. This was after these events, because we were paying a very high price for that property and the hotel. they were charging us as though each of those rooms, as hotel rooms, was occupied every night at full price. We got a break in a way because the man in charge of the hotel for the Chinese had a modernizing program which was being done out of Hong Kong, and for which, of course, he was paying hard currency. And so we asked, would we pay our rents in hard currency? And we worked it out, so yes, we would. We'd pay them in Hong Kong, but we would then get a discount for that. On a subsequent visit, I asked Dick Williams, our consul general, how the hotel had made out on that investment. This was about 10 months after the completion of the program. He said he'd only recently asked the manager how it had gone, and that he expected to be fully reimbursed before the year was out. So we were paying a very high price, and they offered us some land which had a building on it, including a Chinese broadcasting facility. We accepted that. That is, we recommended to Washington that it be accepted, and Washington was prepared to okay it. But then suddenly the Chinese withdrew that, mm-hmm. claiming that the tenants could not find other places to move and refused to move. Now that could have, as you know, in China, the tenants have substantial rights and can just squat there, and they are not as free to use eminent domain as we are in our country. But what they're, in the first instance, offering us that old Vietnamese consulate, they had hoped to have all the consulates on the island in the one place. And I don't know where that situation is now.
Because I know Harry Thayer was a little bit, he felt a little bit upset with Mondale's trip, and in this one regard, he felt that we had cost him a little bit of money in the vice president's desire to open up a consulate.
Locating
in the hotel and that forcing the issue through.
We'd have had to locate in the hotel anyway. We had no other place to go. Because even had we obtained another site, there would have been 18 months, 2 years of preparation of building before that site would have been usable. So that would have happened in any event. We might have made a better deal on the rent, but even that is doubtful. On such matters, the Chinese know you have no alternatives, and it's just take it or leave it proposition. Then there was a provincial banquet at the guest house banquet hall on that Friday night, which although quite festive, did not compare with the one in Xi'an.
That's funny, I don't remember that one.
It was more old hat to them, of course. Whereas in Xi'an, it was not only the Vice President of the United States, it was truly an event.
That's right.
It's possible that the first one of its kind that those provincial authorities had ever had. That's obviously not true in Guangzhou.
That, and of course, since the excavations have been there, they've really begun to receive quite a flow. When Jimmy Carter went out there later in the summer of 1981, the King of Belgium had preceded him, a couple other kings, I think. It's now a de rigueur spot, but at that time, you're right. There were very few people out in the streets for the vice president in Canton too.
That's
not the
true.
Same, not the same kind of attention.
At the as we came out of the Peasant Movement Institute, the vice president went across the street. There were some crowds there, but they were thin in comparison of what had happened the night before. Of course, that was also the dinner hour. And it's pretty hard to compete with the Chinese at mealtime. Then we took the train on Saturday, the 1st of September, to Hong Kong. There was some difficulties with the Chinese on the taking of the train, weren't there, as I remember it?
I don't recall that.
No?
You mean in planning of the trip, and that they'd wanted him to leave by plane?
That's my memory of it. Or was it that he wanted to ride in the regular cars, and they insisted on a special car?
I think that was a concern, but then they put a special observation car at the back of the train for him. Actually two cars for his party, and then he walked up and down the whole train shaking hands with everybody. Remember the Washington Bullets were on the same train,
and
he walked all the way up, said hello to them.
Right. Now after the provincial banquet
before we leave, I must give you one insight into the relations between Fritz Mondale and President Carter. I had no insight into that relationship at all. Oh, are you good? Oh, good, good, good.
The night before, the last night in Guangzhou.
By all means.
I know that, isn't that when we first got word about the ferocious rabbit?
Yeah, that's the incident I wanted to recall. Excellent.
The fighter rabbit. And I remember, Vice President saying to me, "Good God, now I'm going to have to go back home and fight rabbits." But after the banquet, everybody was in a very relaxed and jovial mood, particularly the Mondale staff. And the completion of an extremely successful trip, they had every right to be. But Sharon went down to their quarters for some reason. There was a great deal of talk that night about the necessity of the vice president asserting himself, doing something. When I went down there, that kind of conversation continued. There must have been a lot of things happened before that to have such a culmination, because that one incident of the rabbit by itself would not have brought all that out, but that sort of was a trigger that released a lot of emotions and made you realize the difficulties that the administration was facing in a political way.
Oh, he was just... I was surprised because obviously this was in a room that one could not assume was private, shall we say. Assume that there were perhaps bugs in the room.
That also.
And here was the Vice President of the United States, and with Dick Moe and with
Jim Johnson.
I think Dick Holbrooke was there. Al Isley, I was there, you were there, and they just went on and on about this rabbit, the killer rabbit, and then they were just making up different stories as to what could have transpired. Could the rabbit have really been off on land? Where was the president actually? And Mondale seeking more information. We were just all absolutely in hysterics. But it really did reveal a as you say, a some deeper currents there, and a feeling that President Carter was not doing all he could to keep the country in a Democratic column the next election.
Well, on the train from Guangzhou to Hong Kong, the Vice President and I had a long conversation, and which also involved what was I going to do, and that see what had happened. Involved my doing something. I should be able to remember that. And I was temporizing, very frankly. And he was left on the basis, well, when you come back, and it was anticipated I'd be back in the United States for the annual
UN
meeting at the UN on the occasion of the General Assembly, that I should come in and talk to him. One reason that I was temporizing was remembering the night before, Peking suddenly seemed to be very comfortable.
Well, I think that it now is clear the Vice President had opposed many of the President's acts just weeks before up at Camp David with respect to firing the cabinet, the nature of the Malays speech,
right.
Is there a spiritual problem in the land? And the President had really gone against it on a number of issues. And probably on balance, Mondale was correct in his political judgment.
Question about it. I'm now reacting to the speech, or the basic thrust of the speech. I'd had quite a bit to do with the pollster. What's his name?
You mean President Carter's,
yes.
Pat Cadell.
Been very much involved with him in 72 during the McGovern campaigns. And then the UAW for 6 months or a 12-month period were a subscriber to a special service that he put out. And we had dropped that service, not only because it was not of much use to us, but the pessimistic approach. I just thought, yes, things were pretty bad. This, of course, is pre-Carter. But it just didn't jibe with the way I felt the vibrations in the national psyche. I think I can understand why a man of President Carter's religious temperament could respond to such a thing, because it fitted in with that general philosophic approach, I would think.
Of course, you missed the gas lines. Part of it was a reaction of how you handle the gas lines and the demoralizing effect of the increase in oil prices and all that was part of the mood of the time. But still, I agree with you, it had to be handled in a much more pragmatic way. The American public was prepared to take on, I think, some of the sacrifices entailed.
Well, that's always been the attitude of the American people. When something's wrong, and they are told in what they think is an honest fashion, here's what should be done, and they have the reaction, what is proposed is fair. It's going to be tough, but it's fair. They respond. They've always responded. It's when they think they're being conned that they have a negative reaction. Of course, the whole energy business from the first day of the oil embargo crisis was a con job. You know, Nixon set up Project Independence. We were going to be totally energy independent by the year 1985. And I was on that advisory committee. 1980, I think it was. 80, 85, anyway.
I don't remember.
Either one, impossible. When Nixon resigned in August of 74, and Gerry Ford became president, we had a meeting of our advisory committee within weeks of the new presidency. And by law, our meetings had to be open. So we, our morning session, our formal session was open. And then we had a luncheon, and then after luncheon, an informal session where we could have a general non-action discussion without violating the law. And at that time, I made a little speech about, you know, to call this Project Independence is really creating illusions among the American people. We're supposed to bring them to reality. And I would like to propose that we advise the new president to give us another name, not Project Independence, but Energy Action or something. That never happened. And so the whole background of this, as far as the people were concerned, first of all, they didn't want to believe there was an energy crisis. And the speech with the sweater on, I don't think fitted in with what they think is presidential behavior. And it was all a sequence of small events that had an unfortunate culmination. But that was quite a 2 days. Well, then after we arrived in Hong Kong, the vice president, all the ASEAN American ambassadors had assembled there, and he had a meeting with them, which I think was excellent. And then I did not go with the vice president on the remainder of the Hong Kong.
So you didn't go over to the aircraft carrier?
No.
Oh, you missed a great trip. So what did you do? You went right back to...
No. I went... Sharon and I stayed at the consulate residence at Tom Shoesmith's.
Right.
And...
Why didn't you go to the aircraft carrier?
Well, I didn't want to be involved in the Hong Kong business. I didn't want to intrude on Tom.
That was really memorable because he went out... to a carrier that had been involved in the picking up of the Vietnamese refugees, and the vice president had played an important part on the Vietnamese refugee problem. Earlier in the year, he'd given this important speech in Geneva, which had helped really rally support for the Vietnamese refugees, Indochinese refugees, I should say. And so that was quite dramatic to go on a carrier and then meet some of the people who'd been involved in the rescues and had a report on it. And I guess he had a rest of the time in Hong Kong was relaxation, except that he met the governor, and he, since the Hong Kong authorities were bearing a heavy burden on the Indochinese refugees, the focus of the Hong Kong trip was Indochinese refugees.
Right.
And then he had a press conference in the hotel where he was staying. Well done. And then it was wheels up.
On Monday morning, right.
Monday morning. And some
day,
rest he had.
All day Sunday. Then Tom Shoesmith had on the Saturday night a dinner at the residence for the State Department personnel who were there. I remember Roger was there, and Dick Holbrook, heated, not heated, fervent discussion about where we're going with the whole, China relationship, tied in with what's going to happen politically. It was a quite a freewheeling event.